Ladies and gentlemen, diversity is generally regarded as desirable. Diversity provides strength. Diversity in holding assets enables you to reduce risk. And diversity in economic paradigms can help to ensure strength and progress. The diversity in economic paradigms is beginning to decline, or has declined somewhat in the last few years, with the fall or the ending of communism, and with the recent weaknesses in the Asian version of capitalism. So I think it's a very welcome tonic and lesson for us here to listen to Professor Uma Chapra on a different paradigm of economics, Islamic economics, which starts from a very different basis. Instead of eschewing value judgments and trying to get away from ethical considerations, places ethics at the heart of economics and an ethical approach to economics. So I'm delighted to be able to welcome this evening Professor Uma Chapra, who was the first recipient of the King Faisal Award and the IDB Award for his outstanding services to Islamic economics, and who has written many works on the subject, including Islam and the Economic Challenge and What is Islamic Economics. Professor Uma Chapra.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم نحمده ونصلي على رسوله الكريم وعلى آله وأصحابه أجمعين Professor Charles Goodhart and ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure for me to be here to give a brief lecture on Islam and the economic challenge. You know, Muslims constitute about 1/5 of the world population, and they have a different paradigm for their economic system as well as economic science. And it is very important for all of us to understand each other. If there is understanding, there will be less conflict around the world. But it is lack of understanding that sometimes leads to conflict. What is it that really Islam stands for? What does it want to achieve in this world? Will become only partly clear through this lecture because it's only on one aspect of Islam. But I hope this will give you an incentive to study a little bit more about Islam, different aspects of Islam, so as to know what the Muslim world stands for. Now, today's subject is Islam and the economic challenge. There are two words here that need explanation. One is Islam, the other is economic challenge. I will take up the second one first, economic challenge. First one, if I start my lecture with it, it might appear to be a sermon, and I don't want to give that impression to you. It will become clear as we proceed, as I have laid down the framework of my analysis. It will become interspersed by the epistemology of Islam and to enable you to understand how that framework applies. Of course, the challenge lies in the fact that resources are scarce around the world. This is one of the basic and accepted tenets of economics, that resources are scarce. Now, what do we want to do with this, these scarce resources? This is where there can be a difference of opinion. Because one thing can be that we try to maximize wealth and consumption and as a means of satisfying sensual satisfactions. But this is only one aspect of life. I don't think there is any society in the world which is hedonistic in this special sense, not even in the Western world, which is sometimes blamed to be so. Now, what the other goal that we may have to realize with these scarce resources is the well-being of all people. Well-being of all people around the world, and not of any special group of people, not of any special race of people, but of all people around the world. Now, why do we put all? Because these resources are provided to us by God, the Almighty, and they are meant for all His vicegerents or all people in this world. Now, if these resources are for all people, then there is no sense in having concentration of wealth, too high a concentration of wealth, or poverty in one place and affluence in another place in the same country or around the world. Now, this well-being of all people around the world has to be realized without macroeconomic imbalances or ecological imbalances. Why this is the case? Because if there are these imbalances, then the well-being cannot be sustained for a long time. So we have to avoid them as much as possible. Otherwise, it will be difficult to sustain. Now, the question that arises after this is, what do we mean by well-being? What do we mean by well-being? There are here also, there is a great deal of difference of opinion, and maybe I can I ask you to I'm afraid we are all in order. Yeah, that will. What the first thing that we need to have to realize well-being is to satisfy the material needs of all people. These material needs consist of nutrition, clothing, housing, medical benefits, education, transport facilities, and so on. These have to become available to all individuals in society. But these needs have to be satisfied through the individual's own effort. An individual has his own self-respect, and very few people really like to live on dole. If they can find a job, a satisfactory job, then they would prefer to earn their own living. So there has to be full employment and equitable distribution of income and economic stability, because economic instability hurts everyone, the rich as well as the poor, but it certainly hurts the poor people far more than it hurts the rich. Then there are a number of non-economic needs. This is what economics tended not to emphasize in the past. Now people are coming around to it. One of these is mental peace and happiness, family and social harmony, and absence of crime and enemy. There was a paper a short while ago in the November issue of Economic Journal by Professor Oswald on this very subject. Easterlin wrote in 1973 and then again in 1995. And his conclusion after studying, after making 30 surveys in 19 countries, is that rich countries are not typically happier than poor countries. Why? Because, of course, the reason may lie here. There has to be mental happiness, mental peace and happiness, family and social harmony, and absence of crime and enemy. Now, so far, there is no difference between societies, whether you go to the Muslim world, or you go to China, or you go to Japan, or you go to the to UK or the United States. I think there would be few people now who would emphasize only economic needs, material needs. There are more people who would probably emphasize both these needs of human beings. Yes. The difference, of course, lies in the strategy. How do we realize such well-being? And this is, of course, a philosophical question. Philosophers have discussed it throughout the ages. God's prophets have come to this world to suggest strategies. Of course, in very brief terms, it can be stated that we should eliminate or minimize all uses of scarce resources that do not contribute to well-being. If this is realized, in other words, all the goals that I mentioned, material as well as spiritual or non-material, we might say that efficiency as well as equity has been realized. If only material goals have been realized, then of course equity may not necessarily be realized. So if both of these are realized, the two are really very closely linked. A society cannot really survive for a very long time if there is no equity. Because efficiency also depends on equity. If there are a number of poor people in the society, there is discontent, there is unrest, then of course the whole society will ultimately suffer and the economy will start going down. Because this was the thesis of Ibn Khaldun, who wrote a book on the introduction to history 600 years ago. And his philosophy is that as long as well-being is catered to, a society will continue to rise. But if well-being goes down, a society starts going down. According to him, there is no such thing as just economic well-being. A society either prospers in every respect or it starts going down in every respect. If a society goes down in economics, it will go down in other aspects of life too. But if a society goes down in non-material aspects, then it will ultimately go down in economics as well. It cannot sustain its economic growth or prosperity for a long time merely on the basis of economic variables. And this is what we see. There have been three major systems that the Western world has tried so far: laissez-faire, socialism, and the welfare state. Laissez-faire was very good as far as efficiency was concerned. It provided incentive to people, but it failed on account of equity, and therefore socialism came into being. It was because of the inequities created in the laissez-faire systems that socialism got a boost, but it also failed ultimately, and the welfare state got a boost. But there developed budgetary imbalances, and the welfare state is now being rolled back practically everywhere in the world. Now, why is this the case? Welfare state promised so much to the world, and everybody was so happy with the welfare state. But it is being rolled back. Why is this the case? Can the world really live without the welfare state? Can we think of a society where the needs of the poor people are not taken care of, where everybody's needs are not fulfilled, where the other things that the welfare state was trying to promote are not taken care of? Not, certainly not. So what was wrong? Where did we go wrong in the prescription of the welfare state? This is essentially the subject of my talk today. There are a number of questions which need to be answered if we wish to formulate a proper strategy. And these questions are self-interest versus social interest. Self-interest is very important. Any system which does not allow individuals to serve their self-interest cannot survive. And this happened with socialism. But social interest is also very important, and we have to create a balance between the two. If we are unable to create a balance between self-interest and social interest, then the society is going to suffer in some way or the other. Like, for instance, the mystics or the Sufis in the Muslim world overemphasized the social interest, and therefore their self-interest suffered, and the system could not continue very long. Then individual freedom and social constraints. How much freedom should the individuals have? Do they have the right to do anything they want? There is no society which gives absolute freedom to individuals, neither in the West nor in the East. After all these regulations that we have, you cannot cross a traffic light. Why? Because it is against social interest. A person may be in a hurry and he may want to go fast, but he cannot do it because it hurts social interest. So we have to create a balance between individual freedom and social interest. And that's why there have been rules of behavior everywhere around the world. But how to create a balance between these two is a very difficult question. Then who can impose these constraints? Does everyone have the right to impose constraints on anybody? Who do we give the right to impose these constraints? How to motivate individuals to abide by these? We can make any amount of rules that we want, but how do we motivate individuals to abide by these rules or constraints? And finally, is the market the only institution in human life? Should we expect that if we emphasize the market and allow it to operate freely and efficiently, all our problems will be solved? Or are there other institutions in human society that need to be given equal emphasis, if not more? And these are the state, the family, the society, and religion. And we will come to these questions as we go along. This is in a way the framework of the analysis. Now we come to the mechanisms. A strategy will get formulated in the light of answers to the questions I pointed out before, and mechanisms of the strategy will be arrived at. And there are a number of mechanisms that we need. I cannot go into all of those, but I have put three of these here: filtering, a motivating system, and socioeconomic and political restructuring. Now we come to filtering. The first thing that needs to be done in economics is to filter out all the excess claims on resources. Because as we saw, resources are scarce and claims on them are unlimited. So the first thing that needs to be done is to filter out all the excess claims. The question is really which claims to filter out. How do we do this? Whose claims to filter out? Well, there are a number of mechanisms here. There are a number of elements. Price mechanism, this is one way of filtering. The other is central planning. The third is moral values and individual reform. When we come to price mechanism, of course, this is a very important way of eliminating excess claims on resources. And it has worked very well throughout the world. This is what helps us bring about an equilibrium between demand and supply, which is very important. This equilibrium has to be arrived at. But the thing is that what kind of an equilibrium? Is any equilibrium acceptable to us? An equilibrium which leads to unemployment, or an equilibrium which leads to poverty of a large number of people, an equilibrium which does not satisfy the needs of all people. I mean, are such equilibriums acceptable to us? Certainly your answer will be no. Yeah, as long as we live in a human society which has goals of humanitarian goals, then of course such an equilibrium may not be accepted. So we have to do something about it, something about creating an equilibrium which would help us arrive at the goals we want to arrive at. What prices do is that they, in other words, people vote by paying the price. And this involves two things. One is the needs and tastes and preferences of people are reflected there. And the second is the ability to pay. If only needs were reflected in the payment of price, it would be acceptable. But of course, there are a number of claims on resources that do not necessarily reflect needs. They reflect wants, as you must have studied in economics. And wants do not necessarily reflect need. Need, of course, is something that satisfies, that fulfills an essential biological or physiological need of the human being. And want need not necessarily do that. It may be just a status symbol. It may be just a desire to show off, and may not really make a real difference in the well-being of the individual. So there can be a lot of claims on resources as a result of these. And if we try to filter all these, filter out a number of these, it is possible that we may end up filtering out needs and not necessarily preferences, status symbols and so on. The other thing is the ability to pay. A person who has the ability to pay is able to vote in the market. Those who do not have sufficient ability may not be able to vote. And therefore, in this sense, it is the rich who win ultimately and the poor lose out. Now, this will help explain why, in spite of so much wealth around the world, particularly in the rich countries like the United States, The needs of a large number of people are not fully satisfied. Is it because the society is not capable of satisfying those needs? Certainly not. Those needs can be satisfied, the resources are sufficient, but they are diverted to a number of claims on these resources which do not necessarily satisfy needs. And so if we depend only on the price mechanism, we are likely to get into this kind of a problem. If there is another way of reducing the claims on resources to raise prices, then this is what has been done, raise taxes and so on. But this again may not help really, because it is the same price mechanism is being resorted to. So because of this, there were inequities around the world, and socialism came forward and proposed a plan stating that it might be able to create equity, justice in this world. It removed private property. But the question is really that if we are unable to induce property holders to use their property in a way that satisfies their self-interest as well as social interest, if we are unable to do this, then why will the members of the Politburo be able to do this? Aren't they the same human beings who cannot utilize their property as individuals in within the constraint of social interest? If we give them too much power, and this is what was done in central planning or regimentation, too much power was given in the hands of a few people, and they misused it. The needs of people, even in the socialist countries, did not get satisfied. Why will the Politburo members not serve their self-interest just in the same way as a capitalist does in his factory or a shop? In fact, he will do it more because he has absolute power within the framework of the free enterprise system, price mechanism. There is something that restricts the power, and we will come to this when we go to motivation. So what is missing is the role of moral values. In other words, we do not wish to get rid of the market mechanism. No, this is a very important filter, and it should remain. But it should be accompanied by another filter, and that is the moral filter. In other words, there are two layers of filters to be used. The first one is the moral filter, and then the price filter. In other words, before a person goes to the market, he considers this question: is this right on my part to put this pressure on resources? Will this claim of mine deprive a number of people of their needs? If it is going to do this, and what I am going to buy is not really essential for me, then I should forego it. And this is what moral values teach us, whether they are in Christianity or Judaism or Islam or Hinduism, makes no difference. All these religions have certain moral values, and their main purpose, really, the main objective behind all these moral values is to create a balance between self-interest and social interest, between individual freedom and social well-being. The moral values try to create the kind of individual that will be willing to make a sacrifice for the sake of the well-being of other people. And this is where the welfare state failed. It did a very good job, there is no doubt. I mean, the creation of the welfare state in the Western world was one of the great things in this century, but it did succeed to a great extent in removing inequities, reducing poverty, but the result was an excess strain on the resources of the society, and the welfare state has to be rolled back. The idea is that if you want to increase spending in one area and the resources are scarce, then you have to reduce the spending in other areas. There is no way out. What the welfare state did was to to expand spending of the government without reducing the spending of the private sector on non-essential items. Claims on resources increased substantially. There were inflationary pressures, and the welfare state has had to be rolled back because of that. You cannot increase claims beyond what is available. If we do this, it is not sustainable. So the welfare state plan was very good, but the strategy was faulty to increase claims on resources in one direction without reducing them in another direction. Now, what Islam does essentially is to create this balance between individual freedom and social well-being, and between self-interest and social interest. And how does it do this? It has an epistemology based on in three important ideas. One is the concept of God, the unity of God. There is only one God, and we are all accountable. We are all His vicegerents. So the first thing is what we call Tawheed, or unity of God, and the other is Khilafa, that is, man is the vicegerent of God. As vicegerent of God, he is accountable before God. The resources that we have are not our own property. They belong to God, and we have to use them in accordance with the terms He has given us. And these terms are what we call moral values and the epistemology of religion. In other words, there are certain constraints on individuals in the use of these resources. And these constraints are not meant to increase the power of somebody, but really to create a balance in society between individuals and social groups. And in other words, so that the well-being of all people is ensured. So this is the concept of Khilafah, vicegerency of man. And the third is Adala, justice. The most important teaching of Islam is justice. The Quran says that the reason why God sent His prophets to this world is to establish justice in this world. And justice cannot be established without creating a balance between individual self-interest and social interest. And it is moral values that help us do this. But you may give moral values, but what's the use if people do not abide by these? This takes us from filtering to the motivating system. Is that motivating system? Now, how do you motivate people to abide by these moral values or the constraints that religion wants to impose on individuals to realize a balance between individuals and society? Can we use force? Force has never worked and is never going to work. It creates resentment and will not enable us to succeed in creating the kind of balance that we wish to create. The Quran rejects the use of force absolutely. The Quran says, La ikraha fid din, there is no force or coercion in religion. Therefore, he said it has to be totally ruled out. Socialism tried to use it in a way, but it did not succeed. It said that from each individual according to his ability, to each individual according to his needs. And this did not work because individuals need to satisfy their self-interest, and that is what here. We have to have incentives and deterrents. And these incentives and deterrents come in the form of self-interest. If the individual's interest is served, then he will do something If the individual's interest is hurt, he will abstain from doing it. Self-interest has to be served. It is essential for even human progress. No society can progress if it does not allow the individuals to serve their self-interest. But of course, this is not very difficult. Everybody wants to serve self-interest. You do not have to ask an individual to serve his self-interest. You only have to create conditions whereby he is able to serve his self-interest. In other words, in socialism, it was not possible for an individual to serve his self-interest, and therefore he did not work efficiently. We have to create conditions for that purpose. But social interest, serving social interest, is a difficult task. In other words, everybody may not want to do this. And we have to induce or motivate individuals to do this. How do we motivate individuals to do this? I talked about this incentives and deterrents, but anyway, capitalism had, or free enterprise system has, a very important way of inducing individuals to serve social interests, and that is competition. If you have competition in society or in the economy, it is not possible for a person to exploit others, because if he does so, he will lose out in the market. So competition is very important, and there is no way we can escape from it. There has to be competition, and that's why the effort around the world to reduce the power of monopolies and oligopolies and to reduce imperfect competition as much as possible. But of course, competition cannot help us realize everything. There are areas in the society or the economy where competition cannot work. For instance, in the family, how do you keep a family together? Husband and wife and children. Compete for what? I compete with my wife for what? So this does not apply everywhere. Even in society, competition may not necessarily work everywhere, and there have to be other motivating forces like regulation. This has been resorted to, and this was one of the main tools of the welfare state, regulation. For a number of good things were achieved by regulation. For instance, labor laws helped the poor people get a number of rights which they were otherwise unable to get. But you see, when you resort to regulation, and these are essential, I mean, there can be no society without regulations. But there are costs of enforcing regulation, or transactions costs. And these have to be minimized, because if everything was to be imposed by means of regulations, then of course you have to create a huge machinery for detecting the violators and punishing them. And it is not possible to do that, because it will just cost too much. There has to be some self-enforcement mechanism in societies. And how do we do this? First of all, the concept of Islam here is that man is not a born sinner, he is good by nature. He does many things out of his own accord. He doesn't have to be pushed to do it or forced to do many things. Many people try to help other people without expecting anything in return, unreciprocated altruism. This we see in human societies everywhere. Not in just Muslim societies, in Christian societies, Jewish societies, or Far Eastern societies, people everywhere want to help other people in certain ways. I mean, even though they are not going to serve their self-interest by this. This is innate in human nature to a certain extent, but it is not enough again. There has to be some other power of making people cooperate with each other and to sacrifice for each other. And this cooperation and sacrifice is not easy to get. And it's here that that religions have an important role to play, because they try to motivate people in a way that they would be willing to make a sacrifice. Take, for instance, the family. If husband and wife try to run the family in the same way as they run corporations, the family is not going to survive. There will be a breakdown. The basic tenet that is required in family life is that husband and wife try to sacrifice for each other. Ultimately, both of them serve their self-interest, because it gives them greater mental peace, greater harmony in the family, love and affection, the atmosphere is very good. Husband looks forward to going home to his family, and he feels happy when he reaches home. But if this is not there, there is discord in the family, then of course ultimately even the economy gets affected. Because if this kind of a family disintegration continues for a long time, then ultimately, you see, we will not be able to create the quality of individuals who would be able to push the economy forward. We need to inculcate a certain number of qualities in which we will come to that in the next, when we consider. So how does Islam do this? You know, what is the motivating force to make individuals sacrifice even when this does not serve their self-interest? This is also there in Christianity, and that is the accountability in the hereafter. In other words, I am accountable to God for how I live in this world. The more I fulfill my social obligations, the better will my life be in the hereafter. The more I violate my social obligations, the less happy will be my life in the hereafter. And this is a very important motivating power. In other words, we have self-interest here. I want to make my life in the hereafter better. So there is self-interest here, but then self-interest gets a long duration. This world as well as the hereafter. And the hereafter is much longer, infinite life, and we do not wish to hurt our interest in that hereafter. That's why we have to do many things that we are required to do, even when our self-interest, even by hurting our self-interest sometimes. You see many people really hurt their self-interest to help other people. One of the reasons is that they are good at heart. They are not born sinners. They are good at heart, and therefore they do it. And secondly, many of them may go even beyond that, because they wish to improve their life in the hereafter by doing many good things in this world that do not serve their self-interest. But this filter mechanism and motivating system by themselves may not be enough. We have to restructure the society and the economy and the polity in a manner that will be helpful in this. In other words, we have to create a helpful environment, an environment that will be conducive to the realization of well-being of all people in society. This is private property, market mechanism, and competition. These are all essential. We cannot do without them. We have to retain them, and this has been the case all along. It is socialism which tried to abolish private property on a large scale. Otherwise, there were small examples here and there, but essentially private property prevailed around the world over a substantial part of history. Market mechanism has also prevailed. Even in the days of the prophet, the market mechanism was there, and there was competition. The other thing is improvement in the quality of human beings. This is very important, because if the human being is not right, then nothing can work. And of course, this is where we have gone wrong to a great extent. We have put a lot of emphasis on the market and on the state. But what about the human being himself? There has been emphasis only to the extent of improving his technical abilities, enabling him to be more efficient so that he can produce more with the same resources. But this is not enough. This is not the only aspect of human life. There is another aspect of human life, and that is how he is able to get along with other people. How he gets along with his wife, with his children, with his parents, with his brothers, with his neighbors, with other people in society. And this is where the quality of the human being comes. And this quality has to be improved. If this quality is not right, or if this quality goes down, then no civilization can survive. Ultimately, it will start sliding downwards and become a marginal case in human history. So, Ibn Khaldun's emphasis on this aspect of the rise and fall of civilizations is very important. To improve human beings, we need moral values, moral reform. But how do we bring about moral reform? If the family is disintegrating and the schools are secular, they don't impart moral education to people. In the Western societies, when secularism came, schools stopped imparting moral education. But families did this. Therefore, they compensated what the schools should have done. But now, when the families are disintegrating, what is going to happen? Who is going to take care? If the mother in the single parent families, mother is busy earning, and the children do not get the attention that they require, or the father is unable to give them the attention, at least one of the two parents has to give them the kind of upbringing that they need. Without this, the quality of the human being cannot be improved. So schools have to impart moral education, and families have to do the same. If none of them does this, then we are going to face problems in the future. And societies decline not over 10 or 20 or 50 years. It takes sometimes 100 or 200 or 500 years for the decline really to become reflected in the all aspects of society. Then there has to be a social self-help program so that every individual in society, because if we do not fulfill the needs of people, then of course we are reducing their quality. There is a certain minimum amount of economic well-being that has to be ensured. And this the welfare state tried to do. It did not take care of the moral aspect of well-being, but it did try to take care of the economic aspect of well-being. But if the welfare role is rolled back, then what is going to happen? Where are we going to end up? So there is a certain minimum amount of economic well-being that has to be ensured. And for this purpose, there has to be a social self-help program. And Islam has instituted a zakat system where everyone pays a certain percentage of his wealth for the well-being of the poor. And now this is not for everyone. People who can take care of themselves by deductions from their salaries. This has to continue. In other words, this is not meant for everybody, like the welfare state was trying to do, that there was no means test. And therefore, everybody was able to draw upon the generosity of the welfare state. And this cannot work. So there is a system of zakat whereby it is the religious obligation of every individual to pay a certain percentage of his assets every year for the well-being of the poor. And then our inheritance system does not pass the entire wealth to any one child. It gets distributed to all members of the family in a certain formula which has been prescribed by the Quran. Then again, we have to have the reform of the financial system. And because the financial system, interest-based financial system, has the tendency to promote concentration of wealth. A number of Western authors have also written on this subject. And the system has to be changed so that the resources that are made available by the society, everybody puts money in the bank. These are the resources of the society, and therefore the benefit of these resources should go to a greater spectrum of society. If this is not done, we will not be able to reduce the concentration of wealth. And that's why, in spite of the welfare state, in spite of progressive tax system, it has not been possible in Western societies to reduce the inequalities of income and wealth. All reports that come, they indicate that the inequalities of income and wealth have been continually rising in spite of the welfare state and the progressive tax system. And the state has an important role to play in all this. The laissez-faire system, of course, is not workable, because there has to be somebody, some organization that tries to bring about, to enforce these values and these constraints on individuals and society, and to try to make the system work. Of course, it is not going to be like the the totalitarian state. It is not going to be like the laissez-faire state either. It is going to be something in between. A balance has to be created. And of course, I must admit that Muslim societies have been unable to create a balance here, and a number of the problems have arisen because of this. So the family and the society, family is important because it is the breeding place of all individuals. Individuals who work in the market, firms, corporations, schools, colleges, everywhere, the individuals who work there, where do they come from? They come from families. These are the breeding places. And if the family disintegrates, the society cannot survive. And therefore, if we apply the principle of serving self-interest even to the family, we are going to create problems. So now the last part of my talk today, Islam, I have already to a certain extent covered this, Tawheed, Khilafah, the vicegerency of human beings. They are all brothers unto each other, and therefore the resources that God has provided are meant for all, not for any individual, any single group of people, and for ensuring the well-being of all people. This is human brotherhood, and resources are a trust, and the terms of the trust have been specified by the Quran and the Prophet's traditions. The justice has to be established. This is the most important objective of Islam in this world. Of course, this is all right, but as far as the Muslim world goes, because of centuries of degeneration, we are far behind in this respect. Justice, although justice is the most important teaching of Islam, it is the most conspicuously missing element in Muslim societies at the moment. And that's why you see so much turmoil and unrest. And there has to be reform in the Muslim world. And this reform is, of course, a very difficult thing to it. Now that they have acquired independence, gradually they will move towards this. And there are a number of Islamic organizations working for reform in the Muslim world to increase justice. But there are some people who are impatient. And although the method suggested by Islam for social reform is conviction, arguing in a good way with people, trying to show them the right path, many people, but this takes time. Many people want to attain things in a short period of time and they resort to violence. Now this is there, do not represent even a very small minority of the Muslim population. They are a very, very infinitesimally small minority. But it is these people who get the most attention. And they resort to violence, and then the news media here says that Islamic terrorism. What is this Islamic terrorism? Islam does not teach terrorism. It is an absolutely anti-terrorist ideology. But there are some people who are impatient, who want to bring about reform very quickly, and of course they will not succeed. In fact, they are creating hindrances in the path of reform. Therefore, we have to see that the majority of the Muslim world is striving for reform, but it is going to take time. And this reform is to be brought about by peaceful means. But there is a small minority which resorts to terrorism, and Muslim Islamic terrorist would be right only if there can be a Christian terrorist or a Jewish terrorist. Christianity does not teach terrorism, nor Judaism, nor Hinduism, nor Islam. And therefore, if there are terrorists in the Western world and they are not called Christian terrorists, why should this adjective be applied to the Muslims and call them Islamic terrorists? Thank you.